Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking the environment, we're talking biodiversity, and we're talking where we're putting our money when it comes to that as well. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you keeping?
Not too bad. And yourself, Tony?
It's like I only saw you yesterday evening.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I don't know. We've also, just listeners' benefit, there's a police event coming on, I think we're going to do Thursday evening, a live podcast online. So if you're a patron, check your feed. That link will be coming out soon. Really good panel lined up. And there's also the return of the Sunday special, where we'll be getting back on the saddle there, where we'll be reviewing the week.
Dying to get into it. Dying.
Yeah. So that's coming again. If you're a member of patreon.com/tortoiseshack, you'll see the information there as it comes out, as we put it together. And really looking forward to some of the stuff this week. Also, Niall Conroy will be joining us from Australia, and many you'll be familiar with Niall because he's headed up a lot of their COVID response as a coordinator for what they do there. Anyway, look, enough patting ourselves on the back. It's a pleasure, as always, to be rejoined on the podcast by our friend, investigative journalist with noteworthy Niall Sargent. Niall, how are you keeping?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back, guys.
Not at all. We had to have you back on, to be honest with you, because you've come out with yet another blockbuster of a two-part investigation into Ireland biodiversity, what the statistics look like, and some of the more glaring misses we have. Niall, again, we do this every time we talk to you. Do you mind giving listeners that kind of overview? I know it's a huge piece. The links are in the bio, guys. Go read it. I think the first part is a 26-minute read. If you're like Martin, it only took me about 12, 13 minutes. But nonetheless, Niall, do you want to give us a little bit of a helicopter view, please?
Yeah. So essentially, in this two-parter, we tried to look at looking at the state's record in biodiversity protection. So where are we going wrong? Where is biodiversity in trouble? What have we been trying to do? And are the right resources in place? There's no point in going too much into detail. We all know that the natural world is significantly impacted by our human hand. It's through habitat loss, degradation, overexploitation, pollution, climate change. You know, in Ireland, that particular problems are emanating from intensification of agriculture, from extraction of our peatlands, and from planting of conifer plantations on peatlands and high nature value. We covered that in a different investigation last year. So those would be key impacts. What's happening then is you have a quarter of our bird species are in serious conservation concerns. So they're on this international red list, essentially, that if we don't do things fast to change the situation for them, we might not have them on our island anymore. That includes the curlew, corncrake, puffin, these iconic species.
Hen harriers. Niall, I looked at that. Sorry to interrupt you, and I'll let you get back on it. I've read the piece, I've read it in detail, but there's also a staggering statistic that says there's 101 vulnerable birds, bees, and mammals in Ireland. It seems to be quite a high number of species that are in danger of disappearing from the island.
Yeah, there's quite a few. A lot of the bird ones, like some of the ones we were talking about there, curlew, corncrake, hen harrier, puffin. You've got stuff, ones that might not be as sexy but are important, like the freshwater pearl mussel. Atlantic salmon is potentially in trouble as well. There's different species of shark and others. So there's a whole range. But beyond the species themselves, the habitats are in real trouble. There's 59 Irish habitats are assessed every few years, and only five of them in the latest assessment from 2019, only five of the 59 are in a favorable condition, which means the vast majority are in a poor condition, and almost half of those are degrading, essentially getting worse since the previous assessment. So, you know, there's significant issues in biodiversity. The biggest problem then is, how did we get here? Which is what we wanted to look at from the top level down. What resources have been put in place? What are we doing? It's been found, there's two fantastic research, pieces of research done by UCD in recent years to look at biodiversity spending in Ireland. They found we're spending well below internationally accepted levels for biodiversity protection. The majority of that then has been spent on agri-environmental scheme that not just Irish experts, the state's own papers and the EU Qatar auditors has all said is, while doing some positive things, are failing to tackle biodiversity loss. Like they're just sort of touching around the edges, just on the periphery of the problem. While we intensify agriculture, they're never doing the thing they should be. Another key issue is that the National Parks and Wildlife Service, the NPWS, is severely understaffed and under-resourced and has been for a long time. They're well below the funding levels they had pre-recession, and the funding and resources they had pre-recession were not good enough either. So there's a massive issue there.
Can I come in on and just relate back to the second piece of your article, which refers to this, and it says that, you know, the globally we're spending about 80 billion a year on biodiversity. And that sounds wonderful as you outline, but we need to be spending closer to 500 billion to do that. Yeah, yet Ireland is even below that. If you take it on a pro rata basis, we're much lower as a country. We're behind our international peers, who are in turn well behind where it needs to be. And I mean, you go into great detail on that, but you also point out that we're spending money in many of the wrong places. It seems to be, Niall.
Yeah, so a lot of, I think it's about 75% of what we would spend, the state would spend on biodiversity measures. Like I said, go to these agri-environmental schemes, predominantly one called GLOSS, which is under the EU subsidy model. So, you know, there is some fantastic aspects of it. There are some great people and farm advisors trying to help in that area. But overall, it's been found, like I said, numerous reports at this stage that, you know, it's just touching on the peripheries. What positive things you get through those models, which essentially, you know, you basically farmers are getting paid to do things on their farm that will enhance biodiversity. The problem is it's a very prescriptive model. So it's tick the box that you're doing the action, but you're not actually getting paid on the results that you achieve. So that's a major problem, because how much of it has actually been measured, how much of a difference has been made, we don't fully know. And like I said, against intensification of agriculture, it's kind of just barely making a dent on biodiversity loss. I don't know anybody to do this, but if I could touch on one of the positives already, is that, you know, there is a big push from Europe, and there's some fantastic work being done in Ireland as well on this more results-based model, which is rewarding, where farmers are working with communities, ecologists, other biodiversity experts, farm advisors, and these results-based models where you're paid by the results that you achieve. So it's not just about having the quantity of biodiversity, it's also about having the quality, and you get paid more by the better quality of habitat and biodiversity protection on your farm. So that's one of the big results. But again, it comes down to crunching the numbers. Are we going to put the money there? Are we going to give the resources to the NPWS, to farm advisors, to ecologists to do this work? That's the big question that hasn't fully been answered yet, with or without the Greens in power. There was a lot said last year of the NPWS getting a funding boost, and there's been a lot more rhetoric, and, you know, the Climate Action Plan, etc., like there is, or the new bill. There are significant changes coming in, but the funding that the biodiversity needs is far in excess of what they got last year. So there's a lot more work to do. And beyond that, the NPWS really needs to come out from the shadow of a governmental department. It's kind of been thrown around between different departments over the last decades and different ministerial briefs. And when you talk to the likes of rangers on the ground, there's a big problem for them to stand up and be heard, because there's a lot of fear of repercussion for what might happen if they speak out about, you know, if it's poor management or lack of resources. So they really need to be a standalone agency with more powers, more resources, and more rangers on the ground to do the work that we need. Because we can talk about this probably as well, is our national park system and our network of 600 plus protected nature sites, there's very little management of them really taking place to the level that is required to make sure biodiversity is protected.
I'm going to interrupt the podcast to ask for your support. It's the beginning of the month, so now is the best time for you to join. You pay your $5.50 a month, you check us out for the month, and then if you don't want to hang around, you can cancel next month and see what all the fuss is about. But I'd hope you'd stick around. We've lots of content coming your way, lots of great stuff lined up, including conversations with the Minister for Housing and Sinn Féin Housing spokesperson Eoin O'Brien. We have the return of the Sunday Special, which is the live show there, whereby patrons, members of the Tortoise Shack family get to come together, sit in on events of the week and have an open Q&A, including we can turn the mics on. Policed is back as well, and you know, on Thursday evening, there's a live Policed that's going to feature some of the voices from the previous seasons, as well as the likes of Mick Clifford from the Irish Examiner. You get to attend those online if you are a member. We really do need the support. There's no way to sugarcoat that. It's been a bit of a catastrophic few months, as you'd imagine. But we are continuing to grow, and yet we need more people to sign up. Please, if you can, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of options, but for your $5.50, try it for the month. What have you got to lose? Really appreciate it. Let you get back to your podcast.
And I was just going to say that to you, the NPS, you know, you're saying that's pretty low hanging fruit to put that out on its own. So it has some clout and at least has some financial backing that's substantial. Is there other low-hanging fruit that we should just be doing as a matter of course?
Yeah, this is. I think you just give me opportunities to talk about native woodlands. I think that's I always come back.
We
to that.
Always go there, don't we? we're back on forestry again, folks.
But it certainly is one when you think about the vast majority of land is owned by farming community, and that's where the vast majority of the conifer plantations would be on farmland, as well as peatlands, of course. But that's the way it was incentivized. So I think it's a shift in the financial incentivization for landowners to be planting more native woodlands. So a longer support period, essentially, for planting a more biodiverse forestry stock would make a massive difference. And I think, as well as putting more power for the MPWS, more resourcing for the local authority level, because a lot of the decisions, a lot of the enforcement powers are on several biodiversity issues are at a local level. If you look across the councils, some councils will have heritage officers, some may have a biodiversity officer, but you're talking about one person for an entire county at a maximum. So, you know, that's another area where there can be a lot of work done, because the county councils will know, you know, staff within the county councils who really care about these issues will know more than anyone what needs to be done and who to work with in the local community. So those, I think, are two fairly straightforward ones.
That's pointed out by not just by yourself in the report, but I think it was pointed out by the EU that the lack of knowledge on the ground, the lack of, you know, actual expertise were identified by the European Environment Agency.
It's a massive issue. This is one of the things that we kind of covered in quite detail. We didn't necessarily go into too many specifics of individual sites, but we wanted to look at the top level issue of. So essentially, there's this thing, it's a Natura 2000 network. It's a network of protected nature sites across Europe, protected for a range of habitats and species that are at threat of, you know, they're vulnerable or some at threat of extinction or just have to be protected because they're very rare. A good example is in Ireland, we have a lot of protected areas for our unique blanket bog, our bogs in general, and then for other species like the curlew, corncrake, like I said, puffin, lapwing. There's a whole range, unfortunately, of species that need protection. Now, on paper, that looks fantastic, having 600 plus sites, having 13% of the entire country in protected areas. That number is actually quite low by OECD standards. We're in the bottom 10.
We're in the bottom 10
fifth last. So we're down there with like the likes of the US in terms of percentage of cover. The other issue then, beyond just the level of cover, you're only looking at about 60% actually have specific conservation objectives that are specific to the species and habitats they have to protect. So that essentially means that you're outlining, okay, from the scientific data, we have to do X, Y, and Z to protect these species. So you're talking about almost 40% where we have these generic conservation objectives that basically just say, we need to protect this species in this area. What exactly we have to do, that's going to be figured out at a later date. And there's some sites that are waiting decades to get these site-specific conservation objectives. Then beyond that, even if you have the conservation objectives, very few, virtually none of the sites have management plans. So how you actually take that from the paper into the reality. And this, you know, that causes major issues. And I think anyone who goes into a protected area, what would be a SPA, a special protection area for habitats and some species, or sorry, for bird species, or sites of an SAC for conservation for habitats, you go into a lot of those sites and you think this is going to be unbelievable, amazing. Like, I'm going to see so much biodiversity in nature. And, you know, you see a lot of grazing, you see a lot of plantations, you see a lot of things now. A lot of the things were there potentially before the designation as a protected area, but you can tell very clearly there is a lack of management per se in those sites. And again, that comes back to the resourcing issue primarily. It's not to hammer the MPWS on the head about this. There are issues, but you can't cover these day-to-day operations when you don't have the staff or resources to do it. And the experts all come back to this as a key issue.
Martin, you wanted to come in. I just want to make one point before, because just to put that, Niall, we've spoken, I know we speak quite, the language can be quite opaque for some people. We want to make it a bit transparent. But when I look at it, the land underprotected, as you said, Ireland's the fifth lowest level in all the OECD countries. Just to put that in context, Ireland is the second least densely populated country in the OECD countries. There's something askew with how we balance this within the Republic of Ireland. Martin, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Niall, is there a trade-off from government on this? You know, are they underfunding it deliberately, or is it just a lack of knowledge, or is it just a lack of will to actually tackle the issues that they need to tackle?
I think it's a whole combination of things, especially when you take into the importance of agriculture in the Irish landscape. So a lot of these protected areas would traditionally, you know, and still do to some extent, have farming going on, depends on which one, or had, you know, conifer plantations in them. So I think there's that aspect of it. There is, you know, there is an economic value to these lands that are now being protected. So that kind of plays into it. I think potentially you could argue it's politics as well, in terms of how people make their voting preferences when they go in a general election, and the type of parties that they would elect would not traditionally have much of an environmental or eco ethos to them. I think that's probably historically been a factor. And I think it generates the lack of valuation we put on the environment within the political classes and that side, and the policy side of things. And that's where things really have to change. There's a thing called, natural capital accounting, which is essentially the idea that we need to be monitoring and measuring for essentially what biodiversity we have, what conditions it's in, and what ecosystem services that it can provide to society. We need to put that on a level playing field against the economic side of things in our decision-making and our policy-making.
We have to marketize it, Niall.
No, this is the problem. Like, people, that's the thing you want to try to stay away, because people seem.
I know, but it sounds when you use that language, it sounds very much that we're trying to put it in terms of the bean counters. Because you got to recall, again, going back to the first piece, you pointed that the European Commission has 15 open infringement cases against Ireland. So these things cost money, and that all has, you know, that's
in the long term.
Yes,
I think in the long term, yes, there are big financial impacts, political impacts as well, and damage to biodiversity. You look at the Derry Brine case, which was where there was a massive landslide of peatland then into a river, lots of fish killed, impact on farmland, etc. In Galway. And, you know, we were taking the court over that. That was to put there was a wind farm being put in on peatland, essentially, and where conifer plantations had been. The environmental impact assessment wasn't carried out correctly, according to the European Commission. We have massive fines now because of that, and a massive political headache. But again, that's years, decades later. It doesn't necessarily... impacts don't necessarily show up in 5-year election cycles, but we do have to take these things into account, long-term thinking, not just the financial impact of the large fines we face, but also, you know, the climate and biodiversity crisis are two sides of the same coin. If you don't tackle them, we know what's coming down the road with climate. We know how much money it's going to cost us if we don't act. It's the exact same thing with biodiversity. Sometimes sometimes the nature side gets lost or left behind in the climate discussions, but they are the same thing. They are the two crises together that if you don't tackle them together, you're going to lose both of them. And essentially losing both of them means, let's say, a not very good thing for our future.
So robot trees aren't going to cut it.
let's not go there.
No, let's not go there just yet. But back to the agri-enviro piece that you point out, Niall, in terms of the funding, where the money tends to go. That seems to me to be politically motivated. It seems to be where the votes are and where people are assuaging things. This is, again, me speaking in my capacity. What have you found and where the money goes, and is it underutilized there? Are we aiming it in the wrong direction?
We're aiming it at the right area, but like I said, it's a more prescriptive model. So that's like a lot of that comes from Europe. Obviously, that's the way the Common Agricultural Policy is currently designed. These agri schemes are, you know, more action oriented. So it's about you do X, Y, and Z, and you get a payment for it. So you're not necessarily measuring the result, and it's kind of a one size fits all box for the whole country. It doesn't work like that in principle. You know, Ireland, we're a small island, but it's very diverse, you know, in the type of soil and lands we have. So there's a big, like I said, a big solution there. If you shift that funding more to the results-based models, like, that will have a big difference. And we've already seen that there's a whole range of pilot projects in Ireland for protecting curlew and its habitat, corncrake and its habitat, pearl moss freshwater, the pearl moss that's habitat. And by protecting those species, enhancing the habitat, like I said, you're protecting for a range of other species. And it can make a massive difference. And again, like I said, it's results-based. So it's measured. You get paid more when you actually achieve the results required. And results take time, which means that these things will continue, hopefully, for decades, and farmers getting paid for a long period of time to do this. So if that shifts in the right direction, it'll be great. And this comes back, like I said, to the funding. A lot of these pilot projects, let's say so far, the really successful ones are short term because there's only a certain amount of funding for them from Europe, predominantly under this EU Life funding. That's where most of these projects are funded. Ireland, we've got a lot of money for that, but unfortunately, we haven't taken as much as we could have. We did an analysis of how much, you know, we could have been allotted and how much we actually spent. And we were 10, 12 million under, which could have, it's not a huge amount of money, but it can make a difference in having, you know, a few more of these projects in other parts of the country. And again, it comes down to why were we not able to probably take as much of that money as the EU wanted to give us? The resources were not in place, the administrative staff, the staff within MPWS or in county councils to actually implement it. So again, a lot of these issues doesn't necessarily come back to, it's not necessarily always too much money going in the wrong place. You need funding for agri-environmental schemes because, you know, a lot of our biodiversity is found outside of the protected areas as well in the farming landscape. So you have to put the money there. I suppose it's increasing the funding then in the other areas to the likes of the MPWS or the National Biodiversity Data Centre, which is another story there. The Biodiversity Data Centre is essentially in charge of, the name says it all, about, in, you know, getting the, putting together and holding the data and analysing it. But also they implement the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, which has been incredibly successful in supporting habitat for bees, butterflies and other pollinators. Most people don't realise that's a private entity that is running that because it's essentially done on a tender process every few years. I don't mean private in a bad way. They are fantastic experts, run by a fantastic director. The problem is they're always on short-term contracts, the staff, and there's very few of them. And people think it's this massive organization, but it's a very small staffing and very small resourced. That needs to change as well because their remit is massive, but people don't realize the staff are constantly thinking on a short-term basis because they don't know if they're going to be employed for a number of years. It impacts on their pension, all those things. So, you know, we really need to be resourcing those sort of entities properly and put them on a legal standing, ultimately with the respect they deserve for the work they're doing.
Last thing from me, Niall, and I'm just going to bring it back. I'm going to bring it back to your favorite thing. I'm going to bring it back to forestry. I was reading recently that China has set massive targets for itself for planting forestry, so much so that it's aiming to get carbon neutral through the planting of forestry. Ireland has one of the lowest forestry covers in the EU. Should we be pursuing something on the same level to increase the biodiversity and habitats available?
Yes. No, we do, and I have to, coupled with the fact that we've among one of the lowest, or I think second or lowest at this stage, forestry covers in Europe, is that we have one of the highest, if not the highest, levels of plantation coverage, non-native plantation coverage. So you've got that issue there, because obviously, you know, they go up a few decades, they're taken down, they go up again. We know there are significant biodiversity impacts there. So I guess it's a mix. You know, you do need your native woodlands going up. We need much more of that. And the other side of it as well, from the commercial, we know there's massive issues in the commercial forestry side. You do need that aspect of it, but you don't really need a plantation model. You can have a continuous cover forestry model, which the vast majority of Europe would implement, where you can have the forest land that is going to be for hardwood, say, but you take individual trees when they're matured and you open up the canopy so more can go up. And it, you know, you have, as the name says, a continuous cover of the forestry. So you're not taking it all in one go. So there's definitely ways for a mix. And look, it's one of the key solutions to climate change. I think I'd much prefer to see that than a robot tree forest somewhere in Cork potentially popping up at massive expense for the taxpayer. Which
it's only 350 grand for a couple of robot trees.
I think it's important what you said there, Martin, because there's this idea that the only function of trees is for air quality. Of course, it has a big role, but yeah, there's the climate aspect, there's the water quality, there's the, you know, there's flood retention, there's keeping water, there's soil protection,
actually, you're almost getting in on my last question, because it's a piece that you've actually, it comes up in the pieces, and again, go read them, folks, the links are in the thing. It talks about the widespread lack of understanding of natural capital. Natural capital is something that, unfortunately, the general public don't have an understanding of, Niall, and we need to make, I think that's something that comes across in the piece. If you were to explain, give someone listening now a rough definition or a broad definition, what do you mean when we say our natural capital?
It's essentially the value that our biodiversity gives to us, the ecosystem services it provides and the value we put on that. And that doesn't necessarily mean a financial value to it. You can make assessments of what value they bring, for example, what pollinators bring to crop production. You know, it's in Ireland's estimated, I don't know the figures, sorry, here on me, but significant portion, you know, millions globally, you know, the ecosystem services provided by nature is saving or bringing in billions for the role that they play. But it's essentially accounting for the value that they have in our day-to-day life through that. Like I said, pollinators, if it's tourism, you know, what nature brings, actually the income of tourists coming to Ireland, it's just putting that value on it and understanding that protecting nature has values for society, not just economically, but in terms of flood alleviation, our drinking water, the air we breathe. It's just accounting for that and bringing that into the decision-making table. It's about ensuring that, I suppose, on the policy side, across governmental bodies, the plans and programs that we design put the ecosystem services on an equal footing as the economics and the financial side of things, that we have to make decisions that are also of benefit for biodiversity because of the benefit they bring to us. And it's that rationale. We're pushing ahead now in deciding with plans and projects, are they good for the environment? Are they good for the climate or not? I mean, with the data center stuff, you might argue we're still not quite there as one example, but it's coming in more and more. Decisions been made. We shouldn't do this because of the climate impact. We also need to have on the same footing, we should not be pushing ahead with certain plans and projects because of the detrimental impact they might have on the environment. And equally, we need to be pushing ahead with projects that are good for biodiversity, good for nature, that are also providing ecosystem services to communities by virtue of those values they bring, rather than saying this will be too expensive, it's going to cost X amount per year, when the long-term benefits far outweigh the economic issues that might be emerging in the short term.
Now, thanks for that. Thanks for that great explanation. And as always, it's a pleasure to hear you talk on a subject that you're very passionate about. And we can see that your depth of knowledge is incredible. What are you working on next? Give us a little taster.
Yeah, the one I'm working on one now with another reporter on, funnily enough, we've talked about in some detail there about agricultural subsidies. So we're looking at the current subsidy model in place and the impact it's had. Essentially, is it maybe pushing farmers in one direction, or continuing an intensification of business as usual model? And then also looking to the future of those results-based schemes that I was talking about there. Where are they successful, and where can we be putting more resources into them? And also highlighting, farmers in the country who are doing their bit for biodiversity. Those who are, some of them getting paid for it, but some of them actually getting financially penalized because they want to keep parts of their farmland as biodiversity friendly as possible. They're being told by state authorities, well, they're kind of being presented with an option. It's not really an option. It's kind of, you can keep it, you won't get paid as much, or you can rip it out and have it as for grassland, and you get paid for that. In a nutshell, that's one of the big issues faced. So we want to look at that, the subsidy model, in a more holistic way. And then I'll be working another environmental one on unlicensed and unregulated peatland extraction, which is still a big issue despite...
It looks like you're going to have to talk to Luke Ming on both issues, yeah. I think.
he's on my list to talk to.
He's not hard to get to, in fairness.
And the agricultural as well. He was working on funding for smaller farmers, and I know he had some success this year. Niall, thank you again for taking the time to come and talk with us. As we said, always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Thank you very much.
Lads, if you're listening, if you're still listening, noteworthy.ie, you can support the work the guys do. It's crowdfunded. They pick a topic, and they also pick listeners' topics or readers' topics, more importantly, I should say. And you get to go in and you fund it, and then they do this in-depth analysis and work. And trust me, it's very in-depth. It's really, really terrific work. Niall, appreciate you taking the time to talk to us again. Please do, if you can, put your hands in your pockets and show a bit of support for investigative journalism that actually makes a difference, because I know this is some of the best stuff that you will read anywhere when it comes to the environment. Well done, Niall, and appreciate you taking the time again.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.